Sometimes you feel so alone and overwhelmed, you don't know where to turn. These days, it seems like there is no end to our problems. We invite you to connect with Silent Unity, the 24-hour prayer ministry, where someone is waiting to pray with you right now. Since 1890, Silent Unity has always been there. No judgment or dogma, just someone affirming the best for you. Call 816-969-2000 today. You can also connect online at unityprayervigil.org.
Experience the difference. Unity Online Radio. The voice of an awakening world.
Welcome to World Spirituality, exploring the unity within all cultures and faith traditions, with your host, Reverend Paul John Roach.
So, hello and welcome to World Spirituality on the Unity Online Radio Network. Yes, I'm your host, Paul John Roach, coming to you on a rainy day, actually, in Fort Worth, Texas. It's pouring down today, which we need. So, it's beautifully green as I look out from my window. Today is part two in our four-part series focusing on the state of new thought and unitive thinking in our world today. And last week I had a spirited discussion with Lola Wright. She's the spiritual leader of the Bodhi Center in Chicago. Check out the archives if you want to listen to what she had to say. Today I welcome a true light and innovative explorer of alternative spiritualities, Mitch Horowitz. Mitch is a Penn Award-winning historian for the wonderful book Occult America. He's a publishing executive and of late a leading New Thought commentator. He's written an insightful history of New Thought and positive thinking called One Simple Idea. And today he brings out a new book, which is entitled The Miracle Club, How Thoughts Become Reality. And if One Simple Idea was a systematic overview of New Thought, this is how do we apply it? How do we make this real in our lives? Mitch writes for leading journals and newspapers, appears on national TV shows, and in fact, David Lynch, the well-known film director, calls him solid gold. God, now what a testimony. So it's a pleasure, therefore, an awesome pleasure to welcome Mitch Horowitz to today's show. Welcome, Mitch.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
You know, New Thought calls itself practical spirituality, right?
Yes.
And that's what attracted me to New Thought, I think, many, many years ago. But often there's a disconnect between nice words and the real change, the real transformation. And in fact, you've got a telling quotation at the front of the book, right, by Emerson, which I actually quoted last week. I liked it so much. I quoted it when Lola was on the show. But basically, it says that we have to make in a shortened form, we must make our metaphysics a biography, and if it's got to be embodied, it's got to be visceral, right? It can't just be a nice idea. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, I appreciate your calling attention to that quote. And another part of it is, Emerson wrote, "Metaphysics on its own is dangerous as a singular pursuit. Metaphysics is dangerous as a singular pursuit." And I think what Emerson was driving at in that statement, and it's a statement that he made several times across the span of his career, is that those of us who become professional seekers are in danger of just creating a kind of vocabulary and a kind of liturgy. But he thought that our practical spirituality, and he did think very much in practical terms, our practical spirituality had to be tested every day out in the world of commerce, out in the world of relationships, in the world of artistry, in the world of farming, in the world of trying to get things done. You know, Emerson would ask, how does your spirituality get your crop to market? He didn't specifically say that, but in effect, he did. And he would demand a concrete answer to that, not a figurative answer or an abstract answer, but a very concrete answer. And he began his own career, actually, as a minister, and he certainly had nothing against the profession of ministry. But, and I better be careful who I'm talking to here on the Unity Channel, you know.
But, that's right.
But no, he had nothing whatsoever against the career of minister, but he did leave it, and he did feel that he needed to think and function without being fettered in any way. And he felt that the same is true for the seeker. That was what he meant by saying that metaphysics must be biography. It must be something that's lived in hour by hour experience. And that's something that I really think all of us who consider ourselves seekers, whatever tradition we belong to, and most of us here, certainly you and I, and many of the listeners are dedicated to New Thought, but there are undoubtedly people listening who have other commitments as well, or maybe commitments in addition to New Thought. I think it's profoundly important that we not collect experiences, you know, but that we can talk about what our spirituality does for us on Thursday at 3 o'clock, so to speak. I think too often people will want to talk about their experiences always in the past tense, always as though they're describing to you their vacation, you know, to Disney World or somewhere, or as if they're describing to you what it was like to go to the observation deck of the Empire State Building or the Arch in St. Louis or, you know, some large structure and look out and get this wonderful perspective. But then we come back down and Thursday is still waiting for us. We need a spirituality that delivers to us hour by hour. And I think that's what Emerson was getting at in that statement. It was his way of underscoring that an authentic spirituality must, in fact, be a practical one.
You know, it's interesting. I was looking on Facebook the other day, and I came across this quote from Adi Dar, who was an American, but he became a sort of a Hindu guru. And it said, the quote said that Jesus was never friends with the wealthy, ever. And I refuted that, you know, because I think that Jesus was friends with many different kinds of people.
Yes.
And he was ministered unto, right, by women out of their pockets. You know, they're obviously well-off women. But then then the commentator went on to say, well, Jesus didn't need money because he could manifest anything. He wasn't limited by these things. That's of the carnal world. And I thought, no, that's magical thinking, because that's kind of making a separation, right, between there's the spirit which does
beautiful.
Everything, and then there's this carnal world that is somehow suspect. And you referenced that a lot in your book, you know, that it's a both-and world here. We're not trying to separate the two, right? And there is a tendency sometimes, and you see it in the more absolutist parts of New Thought, and I'm thinking about maybe Course in Miracles as an example, you know, where the world is a total illusion and only spirit or the truth or whatever is real. To me, that's a very dangerous statement, because I think they nest in each other, and unless we accept that fact, you know, we're gonna live bifurcated lives. You know, we're gonna be a little bit schizophrenic here.
You know, I'm so thrilled with everything you've just said, and I feel like I'm in the right place. Not that everybody has to agree with me all the time, but actually, I think everybody should agree with me all the time.
Just
a little joke, listeners. But I'm thrilled by what you said, because I think it opens up a very important discussion, and that is that I think we, within the alternative spiritual culture and New Thought and within the overall New Age spiritual culture, are in danger of creating our own orthodoxy, our own vocabulary, our own catechism, in effect, by getting attached to these concepts that you were just describing of inner and outer personality versus essence, attachment versus non-attachment, wealth versus some ethereal virtue. I don't think any of these things were separated in the mind of Christ. I don't think we see any evidence of that, certainly, within the Gospels. And one must always remember, and I'm sure the Fillmores would be glad to have this pointed out, the first recorded miracle of Christ was the turning of water into wine. What could, you know, how could one find a more life-affirming statement? How could one find a more life-affirming statement? Here he is at a wedding, and, you know, his mother comes to him and whispers that the festivities might be interrupted because they've got these urns of water, but they're out of wine. They're at a wedding, a celebration of life, a celebration of union. He's prevailed upon by a member of his own family to perform what is, in effect, a material act. you can view water into wine as the metaphor, but you certainly don't have to stretch your mind to think of the wine as being health, as being finance, as being a job. You know, I find that the vast majority of people who are involved in the spiritual search very, very often, in terms of their inner needs, when they speak plainly and when they speak without embarrassment, are interested in money, recovery, romance. And I honor these things. I applaud these things. These are the water into wine. We are here to be productive, generative beings. If you don't put gasoline in the tank of your car will not go, however spiritual you are, and you will not show up for whatever talk you're giving on a Sunday morning or on an evening, you know, somewhere. And we have to make, not only make peace, but be at a sense of ease and adroitness and capable functioning with the material challenges that life directs our way. I think the final word on this is when Christ utters the statement, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's and unto God what is God's. We don't live in a world where we can dismiss either transcendental or material values. And why even make a division? Why even make a division? You know, the coin in the story of Christ precept is an object with two sides, but one could say it's a whole object, and it's not necessary to make a division. And I think, in fact, Emerson spoke of danger, metaphysics being dangerous as a singular pursuit. That's making metaphysics into a singular pursuit. That's saying that there's the other world, which is important and which matters, and there's this world, which is coarse and which is unimportant. Not only do I think that creates an unnecessary complexity and division in life, but one has to be careful that that doesn't get used as an excuse not to function ably in life, because I think that's another vast problem of ours within the alternative spiritual culture. I look at places like the Mormon Church or the Church of Christian Science or the Seventh-day Adventist Church, to cite three fairly recent religious movements, and they're impeccably well-organized. I don't always see that within the New Thought world. I don't always see that within the New Age world. The Fillmores were wonderful in this way. The Fillmores were experts at managing real estate and property and media. In fact, one of the things I write about in my book, One Simple Idea, is how pioneering the Fillmores really were in their use of media, which is why we have this radio station today. I applaud that. I think that effectiveness in outer life is a prerequisite, in fact, a prerequisite to effectiveness within the spiritual search, because you have to know how to get things done. This is another thing that Christ spoke about, of the children of the world being more effective than the children of light, so to speak. You have to know how to get things done. And he surrounded himself, as many great spiritual teachers did, with people who were effective in the world, like the Fillmores. So I wouldn't draw any divisions between the search and functioning in outer life.
Right. And I think part of the mistake people make is that, you know, they don't understand the right relation that he's talking about. You know, they hear the statement, you can't worship, you know, God and money, and therefore money's bad, you know. But right, I think he's saying you've got to, you know, seek first the kingdom, right? And then all these things will be added in the right relation. So what are you putting first here? It's not to deny that. In fact, he talked more about money than any other subject, I think. So obviously he knew that that was something that was very important to people. And he was always where people were in need, right? Where their interests were. That's where Jesus was. And he was encouraging them, not from a high level of, you know, let's bless out, but from where the metal hits the road, or whatever the phrase is, where it's very meaningful in the sense that, you know, like you said, the first miracle was about a very practical manner. You know, how do we celebrate fully here? It's to turn the water into wine. It's very, very good point. In unity right now, you know, we're beginning to look at how do we approach the nature of God, and there's some you know, books being written that we don't even need to approach God. You know, we can pray without God. And I understand that point of view, because, you know, if God is, as Neville Goddard says, you know, imagination, creative imagination, then that is within us, right? And so we don't need anything without us. But the thing is, you know, I, for instance, enjoy a transcendent God as well as an immanent God. And I like your phrase. I think it's, you know, you want to throw everything at it, right? You want to, you do all kinds of things to approach the divine within yourself, or the reality within yourself, whatever phrase you want to use. We don't have to throw out the baby with the bathwater, in other words.
Yes. It's interesting. There's room, of course, for a radically ecumenical approach in New Thought, and I think that's been one of the helpful things about New Thought. I have liked and I do appreciate Unity's distinction as a congregation, at least historically speaking, that has emphasized Christian language and Scripture. I don't necessarily, at this particular time in my life, make that emphasis personally, but I certainly have. And I don't think that we all need to, I don't think we need to view religion necessarily as a kind of melting pot. I do think there needs to be room for everyone, but I don't think that every congregation needs to sound the same. And I think actually one of the things that the Fillmores brought to Unity that was truly distinctive was a cognizance of Christian language, story, tradition, liturgy, and I like that. I think it has always helped Unity stand out on the New Thought landscape. People can pursue whatever they wish as individuals, but culturally, I think that's part of Unity that should be preserved.
Right, and there's a spectrum, like you said, from the very Christ-based or Jesus-based teachings of some churches to the prosperity gospel of others, and then in my case, very great interest in Eastern philosophy, Eastern religions, which Charles and Myrtle also studied, right? They studied Hinduism and Buddhism and esoteric teachings, so the Hermeticism, whatever. So they were open to those parts of, and I think that's one of the things that makes Unity and probably New Thought too difficult to define, are all things to all people. I was once on a radio show with a fundamentalist preacher, and he summed it up by saying that he was trying to nail honey to a wall, and I was the honey. I kept slipping and sliding all over the place because I couldn't be pinned down. Well, of course, I didn't want to be pinned down because he's trying to make me a sinner. But the inbuilt difficulty is trying to define, what exactly is New Thought. If in simplistic terms, it boils down to sort of positive thinking or a sort of pablum, like you say in the book, woo-woo thinking. And it's much more profound than that. But unfortunately, when you try and explain it to people, it does seem a little simplistic at times.
Yeah. And the truth is, I think I've run a, I've stopped being concerned about whether or not the philosophy or any philosophy that I belong to comes across as simplistic, because I think it's so important to just be plain with people. I used to be worried that somebody would call me New Age, and then I embraced the label and I found it much easier to just welcome it if people decided to use it. They're going to use it eventually anyway, and I'm perfectly aware that many people within our intellectual life use New Age as an epithet, as a put-down, as an insult. But I defend the use of the term because to me it means therapeutic spirituality, period.
Mm-hmm.
And I have reached a point in my life where I'm done running away from the fear that somebody's going to call my spirituality simplistic or something. And I encounter it distantly from time to time. Lots of people, for example, on the alternative spiritual scene like to put down the book and movie The Secret. There's this big backlash against The Secret as if it connotes everything that's unserious, and no one should have confused my search with that pablum that's being sold through The Secret.
Right, exactly.
And, I think, frankly, mostly that's just insecurity. Most of the people who say that have never even seen or watched The Secret. I decided to rewatch the movie a few months ago with one of my kids, and I actually liked its values. I don't have any argument with The Secret. I have my differences with Rhonda Byrne, and I've been clear many times about those differences, but I have no great argument with it. I don't use the term law of attraction myself, for example, because I think too often that connotes one giant mental super law that controls everything, and that's not my theology. But at the same time, I want to be plain. I want to be clear. So if that means using a term like law of attraction or positive thinking or, you know, the secret or what have you, I'll do it if it means getting across a point rather than seeming ponderous because I'm afraid somebody's going to slap a label on me. They'll slap the label anyway if they're determined to. But my principle, the phrase that I use and have for several years, is that I define new thought as the principle that thoughts are causative. Thoughts are causative. That's my contention. And one can look at that on varying levels. I mean it very explicitly on a spiritual level, by which I mean an extra physical level. And from there, you know, begins the search. From there begins the search. We all have our language and ideas and experiences and entry points for what we mean by extraphysical. If you talk to an ESP researcher, you'll get one definition. If you talk to a quantum theorist, you'll get another definition. If you talk to your friend, the evangelical minister who likes nailing honey to walls, you know, you'll get another explanation of what that means. But that's what the search is composed of. You know, we're trying to get at a truth that may never be fully disclosed to us, but this idea of extra physicality and thought causation is at the center of my search, and to me that's what new thought means.
Well, and I think the tremendous freedom that brings is exhilarating. You know, the idea in all our lives that something's being done to us, you know, there's forces beyond our control. And then you come across this idea, no, you know, thoughts are causative. I can make a difference. I can change my whole life by changing my thinking. It is such a freeing idea that it's exuberance. You know, it leads you into an exciting place where, wow, everything is possible. And of course, a lot of the metaphysicians talk about that, right? That everything is possible, that you are limitless beings of infinite possibility, etc. And that's not just you know, a nice idea, makes you feel better. You know, it's actually the way the universe works, presumably. And as we, you know, delve into quantum physics, etc., as you do at the end of the book, you know, we see there's correlations, you know, in the world of subatomic particles as well. So that this is corroboration of this creative power, right?
Yes.
I got to tell a story though, because it's amazing how God works in mysterious ways. My sister-in-law is a good old Episcopal person all her life, but she fell in love with Joe Dispenza, I think he was one of the people on The Secret. And recently, mm-hmm. she went to one of his workshops, and 900 people rappelled from a large building, and she was one of them. And this lady, I wouldn't say, is the fittest lady in the world, you know. And so, you know, anything's possible. So the fact that she's now, a follower of Joe Dispenza and actually put it into practice is not just talking about it, but she got out of a window and came down 30 stories. That's impressive to me.
Yeah. And it's also impressive that she probably retains her identity as an Episcopalian. And
absolutely.
Also experience to Joe's ideas. And that's been, I think, one of the great things that New Thought has brought to this country. You have vast numbers of people from different walks of life in terms of religious observance who may or may not want to wear the label of New Thought, who may or may not have even heard the term, but who feel at liberty to explore these methods without leaving the congregation of their childhood, for example. I often say that New Thought really is the American creed. Whether we know it or not, it unites people across tremendous divides. Somebody who attends a prosperity ministry and somebody who attends a Joe Dispenza seminar, you know, for example, although you could see these things as positioned at opposite poles of the American religious spectrum, they could very peacefully and very easily have a conversation and compare experiences and be in a very productive exchange. From evangelism to the New Age centers and various growth centers, the contention that the mind is a channel of cosmic laws or of higher laws or of a divine influx, another person might refer to it as this experience of being born again. If we don't get too hung up on wanting to be sure that we're all individually from the same tribe, we can have incredibly fruitful and productive exchanges, because this is the modern ideal of religion, that religion is a practical thought force, and it operates through the medium of thought. I mean, that was New Thought's great innovation in modern life, and I think it unites so many of us across the spectrum, whatever our vocabulary is.
Well, and of course, in the last 20 years or so, it's sort of gotten out there. You know, we always used to say unity is the best kept secret in town, but it's no longer really a secret. You know, Oprah is talking about it. Joel Osteen is talking about it. You know, the Methodists, you know, using the same techniques, right? And but you're right, you know, the Charles Fillmore, for instance, never wanted to create a new movement or religion. He just wanted to help people deepen their own spirituality. And Silent Unity today, our prayer ministry, you know, reaches many people who aren't Unity people per se, the
yes.
Catholics, Baptists, whatever. So it's still fulfilling that mission of, you know, moving beyond the limits of any particular doctrine, right, and embracing something more universal. And I celebrate that.
Yes.
Folks, I'm with Mitch Horowitz, and he's written the numerous books. The last two are focusing on New Thought, his new one, and it did come out recently, didn't it, Mitch? This The Miracle Club?
Oh, The Miracle Club is actually coming out next Tuesday.
Next Tuesday, folks, right now. So mark it down. Get a copy. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I've been a Unity minister for over 30 years, and I've been on the spiritual path for too many to remember. But there's a lot isn't here that number one warms my heart because it's things I believe in, but also things that have sparked my my thought and made me rethink some of my ideas. And I want to delve back again into some of the readings I hadn't read for many years, because there's chapters on James Allen, As a Man Thinketh, and Neville Goddard, one of the great metaphysicians, and so it makes me want to renew my examination. So when we come back, we'll talk more about New Thought today. Join us then.
Experience the difference. Unity Online Radio. The voice of an awakening world.
It takes you to power Unity Online Radio. If you'd like to make a positive difference in the world, you can by contributing to this global ministry. Unity Online Radio relies on listeners like you to support our broadcasts that send our messages out to an awakening world. Go to unityonlineradio.org and click on Donate today.
Here's a Unity Mindful Moment with Eric Butterworth, taken from the live lecture, A Course in Practical Metaphysics.
Emily Cady, in her Lessons in Truth, makes a statement which I think we need to kind of think about a little bit. She says, God is not a being with qualities or attributes, but he is the good itself coming into expression as life, love, power, wisdom, etc. He is the good itself coming into expression as life, love, power, and wisdom. In other words, and this again is shattering to some of us, God is not loving. God is a loving God. God is not loving. Because the moment we talk about God as loving, we've got the anthropomorphic Michelangelo like God sitting up in a crowd somewhere with his heart beaming out and say, oh, I love you all down there, so you're so dearly, as long as you're good. But I'm not going to love you very much if you don't go to church and so forth. God is not loving. God is love.
To find out more about Eric Butterworth, visit unity.org.
Since 1924, Daily Word has offered inspiration and practical teachings through daily prayer messages to help people of all faiths live happy, healthy lives. The magazine includes 2 months of daily affirmations, messages, articles, and spiritual poetry to help you get inspired. Subscriptions are available for print editions in large type and Spanish, as well as the digital subscription package that includes the online magazine with audio, smartphone app, and daily email. Get your subscription today. Visit dailyword.com or unity.org.
Look who's making a difference in the world. It's the New Thought Walden Award honorees.
profiled in Unity Magazine, the September-October edition. Unity has joined with its new thought partners to honor 27 leaders serving in the areas of spirituality, healing, interfaith understanding, caring for the earth, and social activism. These are people you need to know about. Pick up Unity Magazine or go online to waldenawards.com.
If you have struggled with low self-esteem and body acceptance, it's time to experience radical self-love with Dr. Ramdesh and the Body Temple. Every Thursday at 4 p.m. Central, Ramdesh guides you to live a more empowered life. Gain a deeper love and acceptance of yourself through yoga and meditation techniques. Listen in as fascinating guests join the show to share their wisdom and help you on your spiritual journey. Join the show with your question or comment here on unityonlineradio.org.
Call now with your question or comment. 816-251-3555. That's 816-251-3555.
We now return to World Spirituality with Reverend Paul John Roach.
All right, welcome back to today's show. I'm with Mitch Horowitz. We're talking about New Thought, and particularly looking at his new book, which comes out next week. It's called The Miracle Club, Our Thoughts Become Reality. And by the way, check out my latest blog. I wrote a little bit about Wittgenstein and my journey recently to Norway and to the hut where he wrote for a winter. It's on my Facebook and on World Spirituality Facebook, so you can check that article out there. All right, we're talking about where New Thought is today, and how it's dealing with the fact that it's, in some ways, it's been co-opted by other movements, other denominations, but yet it's still going strong. It's reinventing itself, perhaps. And Mitch, you know, I noticed in the last several years the Centers for Spiritual Living, you know, which were originally Science of Mind or Religious Science, have sort of morphed themselves, right? They rebranded, and those centers seem to be much more well attended than they were when they were called Religious Science. And again, it speaks to the practicality, doesn't it? Science was very practical back in the 19th century, this idea of mental science. But I think it became a bit tawdry or old hat, and now we're talking about centers for spiritual living. So there's the practical aspect of that. That's sort of a key element, isn't it?
Well, it's interesting, you know, the use of the term science in our spirituality, as you were alluding, goes back to the late 19th century, mid to late 19th century. It was probably the New Thought pioneer Phineas Quimby who first began to use that term in terms of his spiritual practice, and it was later adopted and, of course, vastly popularized by Mary Baker Eddy, the founder of Christian Science, who was a great intellect in her own right. And I think those of us in New Thought do ourselves a disservice by not knowing more about Mrs. Eddy's life and career, because people are often surprised to find how much of our vocabulary, including terms like demonstration or chemicalization or other things that you might read in a New Thought book by a figure like Catherine Ponder or Edwin Gaines. A number of those terms began with Mrs. Eddy, and I think we really should see her as a very close cousin or a great aunt. And I heard last night from a gentleman who lives in New Zealand who grew up in a Christian Science family, and he related to me an experience that I've heard many times from people within that denomination, which is that he experienced miraculous healings at a certain point in life when he was very young, but these experiences did not necessarily repeat. And Mrs. Eddy's contention in using the term Christian Science was that there was an exact series of steps that could replicate, in effect, Christ's healing ministry here in the modern age, and that if something didn't go right, the fault was not in the method, but the fault was in how the method had been used. So there was this contention by Mrs. Eddy, and it was later adopted by Ernest Holmes and others, that these things could be done with scientific exactitude, and that a treatment like popping two aspirins should have the same outcome every time, or there was something wrong with how the practice was being adopted. And I think we in New Thought today really must come to terms with that, because it simply doesn't cover all the bases of life in the 21st century. We are living in a different age. We are dealing with end-of-life issues that our forebears didn't necessarily deal with. People are living much longer today, and these longer lives are not always lived out in physical comfort. They are sometimes accompanied by pain and suffering, and I think we all have an ideal that we want to live a life that is pain-free and that is suffering-free, and we feel that as long as our minds can foresee such an ideal, it can be actualized. And I'm not here to argue with that. I do think that it may very well be, and it's my intimate belief, that mind is the ultimate arbiter. But getting from the point, the framework in which we live, to a point of ultimate realization is quite broad. And within the cosmic framework we live, we necessarily experience a multiplicity of laws and forces. Mortality alone tells us that. Mortality alone tells us that. There's never been an exception to that, and I'm not anticipating one. So we have to accept that while a law, to be a law, must be universal, that law can be experienced vastly different ways depending on the vantage point of the subject. For example, the law of gravity is universal. It's ever operative, but you're going to experience gravity very differently on the planet Earth than you will on the moon or than you will on Jupiter. And that's as lawful a fact as gravity's ever operative functioning. It's not alterable, at least according to experience. It's not alterable by example, just as mortality is not alterable by example. And right. So I think we have to come to terms with the fact that while the universe may be a form of intelligence in the ultimate sense, we live within a cosmic framework that is shot through with multiple laws and forces. And that makes it incumbent upon New Thought to arrive at a theology of suffering. I think that's something that we've never done, and we've never succeeded with. And one of the things that I'm trying to accomplish in the Miracle Club and One Simple Idea is to say that New Thought is still there. It's still there as an option, even if one is dealing with circumstances of suffering, with circumstances of want. It's insufficient to say, well, you're not using the procedures correctly enough. Let's try again. Let's try for the 10th time. Let's try for the 20th time. It may be, in fact, that sometimes life is half a loaf. Sometimes life is half a loaf. But the question is, how can that half a loaf be consumed with courage and dignity and succor so that a person knows that even though he or she is facing the prospect of half a loaf, you still have a vital creative faculty that's ever operative and that it's work and that it is at work in your existence, even if suffering as a daily reality has to be contended with. We're at the early gestation period, I think, as seekers within New Thought.
Well, I think it comes down to the what we talked about earlier, and that is that manifestation is suspect. You know, we want to go back to cause, we want to go back to spirit, and these things called our bodies or the flesh is somehow it's not permanent, it's not real, it's illusory, whatever. And so we can't put our weight down upon it in the sense, and so we've got this idea that, you know, as long as I can be in my beautiful mind, you know, all will be well. And that's really my biggest problem, I think, with being a New Thought minister is this idea that it's too cerebral. You know, the very fact we talk about New Thought and divine mind and everything, it makes it all about the head, you know, if you're not careful. And instead of it being embodied, I do like what's happened in the last few years in Unity and probably in New Thought in general. We started to talk about metaphysical malpractice. You know, when I was in school, I was afraid to go if I had a cough or something because you've been holding the wrong thoughts, you know, otherwise you wouldn't be having a cold. That kind of, you know, fascistic tendency, and which we now label as metaphysical malpractice because, like you said, there's a whole lot going on here, not just what's going on in your head at any given time. There may be numerous reasons why you've got a cough. And so, you know, to be beaten up up about it, you know, righteously is not helpful. Another term you're probably familiar with is spiritual bypassing, you know, where we try and avoid the things that are of this world or of suffering and go directly to, you know, life. I affirm life. I'm not experiencing these things. It's a form of denial if we're not careful, because, you know, the body is experiencing it. It may be hurting tremendously. And if I or any of us go to visit somebody in a hospital who's, you know, terminally ill, they probably don't want me to say, well, this is not real, dear. You know, just enter into the spiritual realm and all will be well. You know, compassion is meeting people where they are, right? As holistic beings.
Yes. I agree with that entirely, and I think that we in New Thought have to be more tough-minded about engaging with the world, not just talking in terms of some, frankly, namby-pamby idea of social justice or a world that works for everyone, but what does that actually mean? What does that actually look like? And I think that people have to answer these questions individually and as congregations. If you want to be an activist congregation, you're going to turn some people off. If you want to But if that's your mission, if that's the wind beneath your sails, so to speak, then you should embrace it. We have to be sincere and we have to be engaged. No, it simply doesn't work to be detached from the world, you know. And I'm not presupposing that everybody should vote the same way or everybody should think the same way within our congregations. I don't want that at all. But we have to have a point of view, at least as individuals. Many of the great forebears of New Thought were attached to and were well aware of what was happening in their world. Figures like Elizabeth Town, for example, the great publisher of Nautilus magazine for half a century. Town was a pioneering feminist. She ran for public office. She was very involved with politics. So was Wallace D. Waddell, the author of The Science of Getting Rich. Figures like Emma Curtis Hopkins and Mary Baker Eddy were not aloof from the causes of suffragism and women's rights at the time that they were alive. Marcus Garvey, the pioneering black nationalist, was very invested himself in New Thought methods. I don't say that we have to walk in the footsteps of these people necessarily, but we should be cognizant that they were informed, they were plugged in. They didn't view engagement with the world as something that was beside the point or that was a kind of unpleasant scene that needed to be bypassed. They were invested in it. And again, I don't have a political program for New Thought, and I don't want to join a political program, but I do think as individuals, if we are ourselves a movement based on the sacredness of the mind, then we have to exercise that mind as a muscle, and we should be able to engage every aspect of life.
Right, absolutely. And there's a movement afoot right now in New Thought and the Association of Global New Thought to make statements at certain times. You know, I know our headquarters at Unity, the CEO there, you know, occasionally makes statements about what's happening in the world, not usually political, but about social action and things that are going on. If we hadn't done that in the past, you know, we've stayed aloof from it because we feared we'd you know, sully the waters in some way, that some people would like it, some people wouldn't, better not to say anything. But I think that if we do it correctly, you know, with, you mentioned skill, you know, skillful means they talk about in Buddhism, you know, it's being canny. My favorite scripture, you reference it in the book too, is to be wise as serpents and innocent as doves.
Yeah.
For me, if we can do both of those things at the same time, you know, then we're home free. And, you know, sometimes we have to be as wise as serpents, right? We have to be in the marketplace. And nobody's fool, but then not lose the fact that we are also, you know, transcendent beings of love and possibility. So to marry those two together, as Jesus tried to do, is, you know, highly skillful. And we're called to do that, I think.
Yes. And it's very interesting, you know, in the question you're raising about congregations or denominations issuing political statements. It's a tough, tough question, and I have no neat answer as to what individuals should do, as to what ministers should do. There are, I certainly know from my own social media presence, that there are a sizable fraction of people who are really into my New Thought and Mind Metaphysics posts, and when I veer into politics, as I sometimes do, get very angry at me and really resent it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Most of my, I would say probably about 30% of my followers on social media are on the more conservative side of the spectrum, and they get angry when I veer off into the, they see it as veering. I see it as just part of my outlook. I'm the same person. But, you know, they get angry. And if New Thought churches, congregations, denominations are going to make political statements, you have to deal with that. And I'm not altogether sure, and I mean this from the heart, not just as some sort of a rhetorical device. I really don't have an answer. You know, this is something that the movement itself is going to have to wrestle with, because there are lots of people who join the party because they like the Think and Grow Rich approach. And I want those people to be comfortable at the party. The idea of individual aspiration has been a vital part of New Thought, and I'd be very concerned if that gets watered down or if that disappears. So, and yet at the same time, we also have to respond to moral outrages in our world. You know, I'm wearing a bracelet right now that says Black Lives Matter. I wear it every day. I sleep with it. But that's not a statement that every congregation is going to feel capable of standing behind or capable of defending, as I am capable of defending as an individual. So we have to make decisions institutionally and individually. But the one thing I am certain we cannot do is bypass, as you were alluding. We cannot bypass. We need to be a movement of driven, motivated, intellectually formidable men and women. We owe that to our philosophy. Those are the shoulders we stand on. And again, if our movement honors the sacredness of mind, then we have to be formidable exercisers of intellect in all areas of life.
You know, you had a very interesting chapter on which mentioned the Vietnam War, and the person wrote the book about it, why we didn't prevail there, because the will was not, you know, to fight that war at home. And, you know, in my career as a minister, I felt this many times. You know, I was ready to move the congregation in a certain direction, but the congregation wasn't ready to go there. You know, they wanted a teaching that would help them live their lives on a, you know, weekly basis. They weren't necessarily wanting to step out and, you know, enter into social action or do something radically different, transformative. So you can only take a congregation or people who are following you, whatever, so far, right? It's its own animal. And you realize that, you know, I'm not in charge here. You know, I may be the minister, but I am not the leader. And unless you're in a more, you know, fundamentalist church that subscribes to a certain set of moralistic teachings, then perhaps you could say, well, you know, I'm representing those teachings, and everybody believes this. But Unity and New Thought, I think, is way too much like herding cats, as we say. You know, it's way too diverse, isn't it, to do that. And I think that's part of the reason why we have a difficulty getting our act together, so to speak. You know, it's a strange animal, New Thought, you know.
Yes. And, you know, I would say this much as far as, you know, offering somebody a guardrail if they're in a congregation where there are deep political differences. There are always going to be polarities. That is part of life. Eve ate the apple. Humanity was granted knowledge. With that knowledge came divisions. That's the price of creativity. That's the price of eating from the tree of knowledge. There are always polarities and divisions. If you're seated next to somebody in church whose political views you find obnoxious, remember, the division is never going to go away, but your wish for that person, I think, should be that he or she be the most ethical, sensitive, careful, thoughtful, responsible person on that other side. There's always going to be another side. So wish for your neighbor that your neighbor, the guy sitting behind you in church or seated next to you, be the most responsible and thoughtful person on that other side.
Yeah, it's a beautiful way of putting it, because that's all we can really ask of another, isn't it, is to come up to their highest at any given time. And as we attempt to come up to our highest, and, you know, even if the highest is just one inch above where we were yesterday, then that's progress, right? We don't have to hit the stars every day. We just have to do the best according to the lights that we're given at any given time. And, yes, we wish that for others. And you have a wonderful insights into the fact that, you know, if we treat others in less than loving ways, then we're doing a disservice to ourselves. You know, there's only one of us here ultimately, right? The what goes around comes around. It's the universal law. And so, you know, we see so much divisiveness on social media in our nation right now. And advising folks, you know, if you're going to hate somebody, then what you're doing is really hating yourself. There's no solution in this. We've got to have dignity even for those people that we just can't see how they could believe what they believe, right?
Yes. And that's probably, if I were a minister, and I've never been in a pulpit, but if I were a minister, probably the one demand I would make upon my congregation is, you know, I don't care how you vote, and I don't care what your perspective is on this or that political position, but if you're going to be part of this community, it is absolutely required that you treat your neighbor with dignity. There can be no exception to that. We can fail, we can make a mistake, but it must be that, a mistake, and not a policy. Online, what we see is policies of derisiveness, of coarseness, of insult, of the first resort being to humiliate another person. Now, there are times where I've made the occasional tweet or the occasional Facebook posting where I've been caustic and sarcastic, and I'm sorry for that. You know, my wish is not to do that as a policy. But I think we have normalized humiliating other people, not only as a national sport, but as the very language of social media itself. And I think as we're talking about politics, I think it's almost not only justified, but incumbent upon the minister to say, look, you know, there's going to be different points of view, but as somebody who's presiding over this community, dignity of treatment is non-negotiable. It's non-negotiable. It's okay to make a mistake. I make mistakes, you know, and there are people who resent me for it, and I hope I'm big enough to apologize to them. But as a general policy, dignity of treatment is non-negotiable.
Right. Excellent points, and I think well stated and important for us all to really cogitate and take it into our hearts. That's one thing about the book, folks, is that it does invite you. And in fact, the end of the book is a call to action, as is much of the book. It's not about just reading it and thinking, those were nice ideas. It's the invitation to put them into practice. Now go and build, as you say. And I don't think we got time because we're almost out of time. But you end talking about quantum physics and the fact that we're not living in a linear time scenario here. We're living in something much more profound, where sort of an infinite matrix where the eternal is always with us, right? And so you speak to your younger self with a number of statements of encouragement, and some of them are quite strict, but I like it, because what you're doing is reimagining or recharging your soul, right, for new growth. It's the old cliche is it's never too late to have a happy life or whatever. This is true, isn't it? We live in an infinite moment here, and so we have charge over it, right? Charge over all the events that we think, oh my God, I could never do anything about it. Well, you can.
Yes, you know, I end the book by saying that linearity is basically an illusion. We know enough now, I think, to say that with a reasonable sense of purpose. Yet at the same time, it's a profoundly powerful illusion. You know, you and I were joking at the top of the hour that I had to be done by 3 because I have a prayer practice at 3, and I have people who I promised them I would pray for them at 3 p.m. Eastern time. I can't very well go back to them and say, well, since time is an illusion, you know, I'll pray for you next week and it'll be the same.
Yeah, right.
You know, I have to honor that. So again, you know, we live in a cosmic framework that places certain demands on us. Linearity is enormously powerful, but it's a method of organization. It's not necessarily the ultimate, which is why I think the novel exercise of going back and talking to your younger self could be much more powerful than we suspect. And that's the note that I end the book.
Yeah, and I encourage you to read that passage in the book, folks, because I found it quite profound for myself, even though I might not have the same the warnings for my younger self. I understand the point of it, and it's very very impactful. All right, in the last couple of minutes, Mitch, tell us, are you encouraged by where New Thought is right now? What's your feeling, your deep feeling about it?
I am encouraged because, and I don't say that cheaply. I would never offer just a cheap answer of hopefulness or encouragement if I didn't mean it. I say that I'm encouraged because I've made what I feel are challenging statements in this book. They're statements that will be familiar to some of my readers from interviews and articles that I've done, and I find that there is a receptivity to these statements. There is a hunger. People want New Thought to be mature in tone. People want to refine the search. They realize that what we're experiencing in the 21st century, politically, physically, in terms of the hard sciences, requires our engagement, and that New Thought can't just stay in a holding pattern where we have answers that come too quickly and too easily, as if they're out of a liturgy or as if they're out of a catechism. I think some people recognize, frankly, an intellectual crisis in New Thought, that some books and congregations have been gripped by a kind of childish language for a couple of generations, and that crib needs to be climbed out of. And we don't need to change New Thought so much as we need to change the level of engagement that we bring to it and be unwilling to bypass anything. And I found a receptivity to that message.
Yeah, very good. Yeah. And, you know, hopefully the dialogue will continue. I know there's wonderful changes happening at Unity World Headquarters right now with the new CEO and leadership there. And I'm on the board of that organization, and it's exciting to see the shifts that are happening, and I'm encouraged by that. And it's really nice synchronicity that you're writing about it right now, and hopefully these books will have some currency in Unity and New Thought. I'll certainly do my part in getting that out. Folks, I hope you enjoyed the show. Get hold of The Miracle Club, How Thoughts Become Realities, coming out next week. The other one, One Simple Idea, How the Lessons of Positive Thinking Can Transform Your Life, has been out for years now. If people want to get in touch with you, Mitch, what's the best way?
I'll throw my name into Google. I am very easy to find. Mitch Horowitz, it'll take you right to my website. My email is there if you want to drop me a line. There's lots of links, interviews. You can put my name into YouTube. There's many lectures. And I'm doing a column currently for Medium.com, so a lot of my new writing is there as well.
Awesome. And next week, Dr. Ken Gordon, he's the spiritual leader of the Centers for Spiritual Living. He's going to join me and tell us what his thoughts about New Thought are. But right now, I want to thank Mitch very much for being on our show. Thank you, Mitch.
Thank you. A real pleasure. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks for listening, folks. Have a good week.
Thank you for listening. This is Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Sometimes you feel so alone and overwhelmed, you don't know where to turn. These days, it seems like there is no end to our problems. We invite you to connect with Silent Unity, the 24-hour prayer ministry where someone is waiting to pray with you right now. Since 1890, Silent Unity has always been there. No judgment or dogma, just someone affirming the best for you. Call 816-969-2000 today. You can also connect online at unityprayervigil.org.